is truly wired about the Monica Gutierrez castro. Your Honor, in this case, there's a lot of evidence that was admitted to our office, should not have been admitted, and the error resulted in an unfair trial for Ms. Gutierrez. In addition, her 148-month sentence is not reasonable, and the minimum mandatory is unconstitutional. Your Honor, I'd like to start by talking about the evidence that was the 404B, the text evidence and the phone calls that were the self-psych powers that the followed. In this case, this evidence was highly prejudicial. It was used by the government to imply that Ms. Gutierrez had brought drugs 3 other times and was not probative. The government contends that it's inextricably intertwined. And there's two bases that can work, and it doesn't work in either one of these. One is that it's part of the transaction. Well, the transaction here is March 2007. She is charged with conspiracy, which happens initially. She's charged with special intent conspiracy. When she decides to go to trial, they supersede with conspiracy charge as a way of getting in this evidence. They are entitled to do that, but I don't think it changes the fact that now with a conspiracy, it's still one person in a car with some alleged undiagnosed conspiracy. It doesn't change the parameters of this case, but it's still a single person in the car with drugs in the car, and it doesn't make it complex. It doesn't make it that we now need to explain this huge conspiracy to the jury, so we need to have this evidence explained, that we need to have evidence of phone calls on 3 other days that have nothing to do with the actual transactions, which the actual transaction was March 6, 2007.
You seem to be advocating this theory of conspiracy? Just creating an error without any real basis of it?
Well, the basis for the conspiracy, and the jury found her guilty. I understand that. But I'm saying that she's charged with possession with intent to distribute. When she decides to go to trial, suddenly they supersede this conspiracy. Which then try to pick back all this evidence.
They exclude the elements of the conspiracy to the jury, right?
That's correct. But the normal thing in what proving that's part of the transaction, the examples that have been given in other cases are someone who sold drugs 10 times, but they're only indicted 5 times, and another 5 are brought in because they're part of the batch transaction. There's no proof that she ever transported drugs in those other days. It's not part of the transaction that serves as the basis for the conviction here. The other examples that have been used are huge RICO cases in which somebody, there's a murder or something that is part of the transaction because it's part of the RICO conspiracy. Maybe phone calls and crossing the border, I don't see as part of the March 6, 2007 occurrence. And then the other way is to say that it is necessary to explain the story. But in this case, it's not necessary. And in fact, Ms. Gutierrez testified that she did, in fact, cross the border, and she did talk on the phone with somebody. So bringing this evidence in because they have to explain some complex criminal scheme, it really boils down to the fact that they wanted to use it to say, hey, look, she did the same thing 3 other times. I bet she had direction for this period of time. Or at least imply that to the jury. And that's why it's so prejudicial. And under 404B, it doesn't pass the test because it does not prove a material point to show that she talked on the phone 3 other times, 3 other days, and that she crossed the border 3 other days. It doesn't prove that on March 6, 2007, that she did the drug search. As far as the modus operandi testimony that came in, we also contend that that was an error. This court has held on many occasions that this type of testimony is inherently prejudicial.
Did you get the 28J notice from the government?
I did.
What's your response to the case cited in the 28 United States versus the Gia Luna?
Well, Your Honor, I would say that it's an alien smuggling case and this is a drug case. I would also contend that there's a slew of case law that contradicts that opinion. I mean, Vallejo is. I know Vallejo didn't have a conspiracy charge, but it's basically the same thing. That it's a simple case with one person in a car that has drugs in the car. Then they bring in this expert to say, well, this is how people in drug organizations act. And therefore, she was acting this way, and therefore, she's guilty. If you look at some of the cases, like Lynn, in which there's two people on a plane, this court has said, that's not complex. It's two people on a plane, one person's carrying the drugs, the other person's with them.
Do you see a difference between drug profile evidence and drug and mode evidence?
Well, I think it's part of the same thing, because in this case, what he testified to is the same thing that the agent testifies to in Vallejo, which is everybody in the organization has a job. Here, you scale it down to, there's certain jobs called scout cars and guide cars and people who drive those cars. But to me, it's the same thing. I mean, saying that different people in the organization drove the drugs and transport the drugs and then deliver the drugs is what the agent said in Vallejo. In this case, he says, so fit the fact in this case.
Well, we have a number of cases in which we have approved the introduction of MO evidence.
Right, and they're usually huge conspiracy cases. In fact, you know, there are sites that it's 20 to 25 members of a structured criminal enterprise. Cases like that. Not cases where it's one person in a car. The case of Lou, the court even says, you know, he's traveling with a suitcase, which are two innocent acts, which is basically what could be said here. She's driving a camera with another car, which all of us have probably done, and talking on the phone with that person. Two innocent acts. But then the agent comes in and says, oh no, those aren't innocent, those are evidence of her guilt. In the case of Blue, the agent said, because he had a first suitcase, instead of just traveling to visit a relative, those two innocent acts that the agent was able to come in and say, those are not innocent acts, those are evidence, MO evidence of how drug organizations work. And this court said that's not okay. That, you know, it's this little probative value is not enough to offset potential prejudice caused by this testimony. In addition, the agent that testified wasn't even qualified to testify about this evidence.
Well, why not?
Well, he had been a case agent for a couple of years. He testified that he'd been a case agent, the lead case agent on the case, 15 cases total in his whole career.
How many cases do you have to be on before you're qualified?
Well, I think more than 15. I think
so something more than 15?
15.
We're supposed to adopt that as a rule of law.
No, Your Honor, but I think it's the judge's, the judge did not make the correct call when he said that someone who...
And said it would be abuse of discretion.
That's correct.
So how do we judge 15 cases is abuse of discretion?
Well, it's not just that he's only been a case agent on 15 cases. Five had cocaine, and only two cases that he'd never been agent on had a low car and a scout car, and here he is testifying that this is how drug organizations work. That can't be enough to be qualified for expert testimony. I think you have to look at the individual facts of the case, but some of the cases that I thought in my brief that the government cited, I mean, these people were talking about 20, 25 years of experience with gangs, and these people are qualified. Someone who's seen two cases of low cars and scout cars cannot be qualified to say this is how organizations work.
Do you discount the training that was received before?
I don't discount the training. I mean, I'm sure he got some training, but he's saying that this is based on my experience as a case agent, and his experience as a case agent is that he's encountered two times when this happened, and this is how organizations work.
Doesn't that go to the weight of his testimony as opposed to whether or not he's even qualified to give it?
Well, it does go to the weight of testimony, but I still contend that the judge abused his discretion in allowing his expert to testify in the first place.
What's the strongest case you have that supports your argument that this agent should have been disqualified for testifying?
Well, I don't know if I have a case that he should have been disqualified. I mean, I think in a situation like this, that you know, this court has put the district court judge in the position of the gatekeeper, but there are times when the gatekeeper abuses that discretion and lets somebody...
Well, what do we use to gauge whether or not he's abused his discretion by way of the law? What do we use to gauge that?
I can't cite a case to you at this point. I would just say that I think it's a matter of looking at the fact that this agent only had very limited experience. And if that's the kind of expert testimony we're going to allow in our court, I don't think that's something that we want to set as a precedent here. If I can find a case, I will submit it.
Please don't submit anything unless you ask.
Okay, thank you. On the sentence, it's our contention that the 148-month sentence is unreasonable. Here's a person who's never done anything wrong in her life. She's 40 years old at the time of her arrest. She's never been arrested before. She's always lawfully entered the United States. She's raised three children. She has worked at her business for 10 years. She has one single conviction, and now she's serving a sentence of 131, which is 12 years.
Which is 2 years above a mandatory minimum.
That's correct.
Which you say is unconstitutional.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Is this a great case?
It does, Your Honor. I think that the parsimony principle and that's in Kimbrough and Gall and all those cases that came out basically said that the number one thing to look at is whether it's sufficient but not greater than necessary.
Well, but the parsimony principle, you implied that we have some discretion. This is what Congress has said. This is a mandatory minimum. And we're bound by my statute. Is the parsimony principle now be ready to the due process clause of the Fifth Amendment to make us then strike down congressional statute because we think that the sentence is too long?
Well, I mean.
How do we get there? That's a long route.
It may be, Your Honor. It may not be right for a decision, but I think at some point the court's going to have to decide that. They're saying the overarching principle of all sentencing is that the sentence should be sufficient but not greater than necessary. Yet it's okay.
The government contracts on sentencing guidelines take plus limits.
Yes.
In general.
Right.
Okay, where we were talking about discussion of this disorder now, that's a good thing because the guidelines are not mandatory. We're not talking about mandatory guidelines. We're talking about statutes.
But the guidelines do give away a schedule of guidelines.
Yeah, we're not talking about that. Well, we don't have discretion. The district court doesn't have discretion. The district court is bound by a mandatory minimum specified by Congress. That's not something the Senate Commission made up.
Right, but they do have a way in the guidelines to get below the minimum mandatory. And why is that not, why is that the only way? Why is there not the discretion of the court to say that there's other ways to get below the minimum mandatory? By saying
because Congress told us we can't dicker with the mandatory minimum. I mean, they set that minimum, and that's what it's intended to be. And so we don't have discretion to deviate from it.
Well, and the problem.
Oh, are you saying that because of 5K1 type of things we should be able to another? Is that what you're trying to understand your argument? Why you can do this with a straight face? Maybe that's why.
That's correct. I mean, it's not like they say that you can never ever go. Well, people do it all the time. In fact, someone's been really situated to this point. He's getting 41 months, while she's getting 148. I mean, where is
the mandatory minimum clause?
No, I'm talking about somebody who pleads guilty, but now, so because she didn't plead guilty and chose to go to trial, she's getting 100 extra months?
It would be hard for us, or maybe the United States Supreme Court might have the nerve to tell Congress that they disagree with them and they're going to change the sentencing form, but I'm not sure that maybe.
If we take the Kimbrough, a parsimony principle, that would be read into what? The Fifth Amendment, maybe? You brought this clause?
Yes.
Would we have to read it into the Fifth Amendment and then use that as a constraint?
It may not be the time, but
I don't know. All right, you have 1 minute before you do the paperwork. Well, thank you.
May it please the Court, Shereen Becker on behalf of the United States. Your Honor, I'd like to briefly respond to the points raised by Ms. Gutierrez's task force counsel, starting with the 404B evidence. The government contends that both the text records in this case and the cell phone records were inextricably intertwined with the charge of offense, and therefore were admissible without implicating Rule 404B.
Were you shocked, counsel, when you said?
No, I was not. In this case, the reason that the text records and the cell phone records were inextricably intertwined, two reasons. First, that both the text records and the cell phone records served as the basis for the criminal charge. Defense counsel has tried to recast this case as a one-count superseding indictment, and that's simply not the case. This case didn't only involve events that happened on March 6, 2007. It was a two-count indictment. Count one of the superseding indictment was a conspiracy charge, and the overt acts alleged in count one of the superseding indictment related to that conspiracy charge, which began prior to March 6, 2007.
Is it the government's theory that drugs are being transported on those prior occasions?
No, the government actually did not argue that in its closing argument. But I would...
Did the government argue it at the other time?
Well, through the government admitted evidence that Ms. Gutierrez Castro made trips from Calexico, California to Chino on three separate dates prior to the date of her arrest. There was nothing in the record where the government argued that there were necessarily drugs in the car on those prior dates.
It could have been a dry run.
It could have been. But it is the government's position that those prior trips were part of the alleged crime because of the conspiracy charge alleged in count one of the superseding indictment. The second reason why those acts are inextricably intertwined is that it provides a way for the government to tell a coherent and comprehensible story. The jury cannot be expected to make its findings in a void. And if we were restricted to only talking about evidence on March 6, 2007, the jury would have no basis for realizing that the government was proving a conspiracy that began on February 27th. And that Ms. Gutierrez Castro took steps in furtherance of that conspiracy as alleged in the indictment as those overt acts of traveling up to Chino and back, of talking to a co-conspirator on the cell phone. And the jury would not be able to make those findings without that evidence. Secondly, I note that Ms. Gutierrez Castro talked about the modus operandi evidence in this case. The district court properly admitted modus operandi, and as Judge Rawlinson pointed out, the government submitted a 28-J letter to talk about the Mejia-Lina case. In both the brief and theoretical argument, Ms. Gutierrez Castro relies heavily on the Vallejo case. And it's the government's position that the Vallejo case doesn't really help Ms. Gutierrez Castro, because in Vallejo, the court excluded modus operandi evidence on the basis of relevancy, because Vallejo was not even charged with anything that would link him to a larger drug smuggling organization. That simply isn't the case here. Ms. Gutierrez Castro was charged with conspiracy. She was necessarily linked to at least other co-conspirators as part of this broader, larger drug smuggling organization. And I would also note, in this case, that the district court took precaution to protect against unfair prejudice by limiting the scope of the modus operandi testimony. Unlike in Vallejo, where the agent testified about the processing and the packaging and all sorts of things related to the drug issue, the district court here limited the scope and only allowed the agent to testify about the use of exotic vehicles and load vehicles. So I would also note that the agent didn't make any ties and didn't testify that in this case Ms. Gutierrez Castro was using a guided vehicle. He only talked about the practices generally. And although defense counsel points out that there is some case law about other cases involving complex conspiracies, Mejia-Luna makes clear that in a single defendant case without a complex conspiracy, modus operandi testimony is proper.
Counsel, what's your response to opposing counsel's challenge to the expertise of the agent?
In this case, the government's response is that Agent Butler was properly qualified and that the district court did serve its proper gatekeeping rule. Now, the government is not arguing that Agent Butler was the most experienced expert, but that's not the standard. Here, the district court went through an extensive voir dire session outside of the presence of the jury and challenged, and opposing counsel was allowed to challenge Agent Butler's experience. And the district court vetted him and then found that his professional experience would provide assistance to the jury and that he had enough professional experience to testify on this issue. And I would point out that the citation by Ms. Gutierrez Castro to the 15 cases where he acted as case agent and the 25 cases, those 25 cases were only the cases that he was involved in which actually involved cocaine. But the record makes clear that Agent Butler testified that based on his experience, cocaine trafficking organizations, marijuana, methamphetamine, many different other types of drug trafficking organizations use similar tactics of this guide vehicle accompanying the load vehicle. So I think the record, or I think that the briefs filed by Ms. Gutierrez Castro kind of shadow the Agent Butler's experience, whereas if you really look closely at the record, he testified that although he had 25 cases that were involving cocaine and a portion of those involved guided vehicles and motor vehicles, he also said clearly that other types of drug smuggling organizations use the same tactics. And I would say that the district court in this case satisfied its gatekeeping role because, first, there was voir dire outside of the presence of the jury before the trial, and defense counsel had a chance to cross-examine and on his qualification. Then, during the middle of trial, once the government began asking questions of Agent Butler, the district court again said, defense counsel, would you like the opportunity to voir dire this agent outside of the presence of the jury? And defense counsel declined. That's at page 173 of the excerpt of the record. And then, of course, the defense counsel had an opportunity to cross-examine the witness in front of the jury. So I do think that the district court, by limiting the agent's testimony only to that modus operandi testimony relating to guide vehicles and motor vehicles, and then by fulfilling its gatekeeping role by through this extensive voir dire, he was qualified to testify as an expert, and that he did not, and the district court did not abuse its discretion by allowing him to do so. I'd also like to briefly touch on the sentencing issues raised by Mr. Gutierrez-Castro. In this case, the government believes that the district court's sentence was eminently reasonable. First of all, the district court properly calculated Mr. Gutierrez's sentence under the guidelines, and then he went through a very detailed consideration of 3553A factors, and it spans 10 pages in the transcript. And he went through those factors, and he considered her past lack of criminal history, her education, her steady employment, her family background, and the fact that she had a good reputation prior to committing this act. And he asked, and the court, importantly, he gave a sentence that was below the applicable guideline range, 40 months below, nearly three years off in terms of the variance. And the reasons that he gave for that were in part under 3553A, acknowledging the fact that she didn't have all of the criminal history, that she didn't have all of these prior bad acts. And I think that the fact that the district court went through that analysis is key. I would also just like to briefly respond. I know that Ms. Gutierrez, Castro's counsel, filed a 28-J letter, I think, yesterday, bringing up a recent decision by this court, which was Ahmed Sakua. And I'd just like to respond that in that case, the district court gave a sentence mid-range of the guideline, and this court found that the sentence was unreasonable because it didn't account for the fact that it was based on a sentencing enhancement within the guideline that was...
It was very, very old.
Very, very old. Exactly. In this case, and in that case, admittedly, the court found that an individualized analysis was more appropriate, and the district court needed to look at the individual characteristics of the defendant. Here, the district court did exactly that. And the district court went through the personal characteristics under 3553A, and based on those, gave a sentence that was 40 months below the low end of the guidelines. Unless there's further questions.
The defendant testified at trial in this case, and that's obviously true, right?
Yes, that's
that
correct.
That was the basis of one of the answers. I thought the defense counsel indicated that she acknowledged that she had crossed the border before and she had a cell phone and she talks on the cell phone. So was that really a disputed issue?
Well, she testified after the government had introduced
those
pieces of evidence.
Right, but okay, so the fact that she had a cell phone, the fact that she crossed the border before was not, I guess she probably had to admit at that point because the government had already produced evidence of that.
She did testify after the government.
Right, makes sense. Okay.
All right, thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you, Your Honor. Just briefly, as regards to media limitation, I don't think that's such a problem for all further cases. There's many, many cases that this court decided that this kind of evidence is not appropriate. And I don't think media limitation can overrule those cases. As far as the expertise, I think it was only 15 cases in 5 that he did with cocaine. And he did testify that other drug smugglers use similar tactics. We also said other organizations use other tactics. And he had no idea what organizations were offering this thing. So, as far as the sentencing, the factors that were considered, I don't think the judge adequately addressed sentencing disparity issues or fully looked at what her background was like. As far as disparity, I mean, his concern was that we have to deter people from committing these crimes. However, people who did the exact same thing she did but don't go to trial are serving sentences of 41 months, and every court thinks that that's enough deterrent. So how is 148 months a reasonable sentence for deterrent?
But she had the opportunity, presumably, could have gone and probably cut a deal with us.
Right, so, I mean, basically it's 100 months for going to trial.
But that was within the guidelines. If you don't put the government and you plea, that's the benefit of plea bargaining.
But the court still could have at least gone down to the minimum mandatory of 120 and said, based on the fact of sentencing disparity and the fact that deterrence is not necessary, 148 months is not necessary to deter people because we sentence people in 48 months and say that's adequate.
But it's an individualized determination in each one of those cases, so it's difficult to say that the district court abuses discretion or acted unreasonably in disagreeing with that approach.
Right, but it's similar to what happened in this recent case of Ms. Kiwa. I mean, it's the same thing where this was a within guideline sentence, but the court found that this was not, the characteristics of the individual were not adequately taken into account as well as the staleness of the prior. And I don't think that the judge here adequately took her characteristics.
All right, counsel, thank you. Thank you to both counsel. The case is argued and submitted for decision by the court.